The Pittsburgh Pirates are terrible. They've got the worst record in baseball this year. They haven't had a winning season since 1992. And while they're setting a new standard for losing, the team's making money, lots of it. That was revealed in financial documents that leaked out this week. David Berry, a sports economist at Southern Utah University, says it's all because of baseball's revenue-sharing program. That's a kind of sports welfare that's designed to even the playing field.
The idea was that the rich teams, like the New York Yankees, were winning because they had money, and teams like the Pirates were losing because they didn't have money. And so what they did is they said, okay, we're going to take some of the money from the Yankees, we're going to give it to the Pirates, and the Pirates are then going to have more money to be more competitive. And what these documents show is that the Pirates looked at the baseball landscape and essentially said, well, you're giving us about $39, $40 million a year. And so what we're going to do is rather than spend the money on players, we're just going to keep it. So the one avenue is Pirates spend money, they might win. Or they could simply say, look, we're not going to spend the money. We're just going to have a payroll. This year their payroll is around $30 million. They're going to have a low payroll, and we probably won't win. But that's okay because we get the revenue sharing money and we'll make a profit.
So give us an example then of a team that does this well, you know, that gets the revenue sharing money and maybe does well without having to spend a whole lot more.
Well, the Tampa Bay Rays have done pretty well. So they've gotten money and they've done very well. It is the case that in order to win in baseball, it really is ultimately a function of what players you acquire. And you can acquire players a number of different ways. One is you can acquire them on the free agent market. Two, you can trade for players. And three, you can develop them through your farm system. If you're a team like the Yankees, you get to use all three avenues. If you're a team at the lower end of the revenue streams who doesn't make as much money, you're going to rely more on player development. And what the revenue sharing program was designed to do is to give those teams a little more ability to go after trades or go after free agents. It's not going to make them the Yankees.
How does it affect the other teams if a team like the Pirates actually gets better?
This is another reason why, from the perspective of richer teams, why they're giving the money to the Pirates. The other teams are saying, essentially, we would like you to be better. We'd like you to have a better product on the field so that when you come to our park, you're more competitive and we have a better ticket to sell. This is one of the peculiar things about sports. When you think about Target and Walmart, if Target goes out of business, Walmart is really, really happy about that. But in sports, the Yankees have to have the Red Sox. Okay, the Yankee fans may hate the Red Sox, and the Red Sox fans may hate the Yankees. But if you went to those teams and said, if you had the power to exile that team from Major League Baseball so that you never had to see them again, would you do that? The fans might say, you bet I would.
Right.
But the owners would say, that would be stupid. I sell a lot of tickets when that team shows up. I need that rivalry. The rivalry is very important.
Has this release of documents and this whole conversation prompted any rethinking of baseball's revenue-sharing program?
You know, there clearly is an incentive problem here. The Pirates simply don't have much of an incentive to spend the money. And if that's the case, then I think the Yankees and Red Sox are asking, then why are we giving it to you in the first place? Now, it's too early to say what kind of conversation they've had about this. But you would think that going forward, baseball owners are going to be saying, hey, you know, we need to be thinking about how this money is being distributed.
That's David Berry. He's an economist and co-author of the book Stumbling on Wins. He joined us from the studios of KONY in St. George, Utah. David Berry, thank you.
Certainly.
A new poll out this week says 20% of Americans, that's 56 million people, have played a game on social networks like Facebook in the last 3 months. Now, most people play for free, but enough of them play with real money for virtual property that these games generated $725 million in revenue last year. Maybe the most popular of these games is called Farmville. We asked a few players for their stories, and these aren't what you usually think of as gamers.
My name is Lee Francine. I am from Fort Mill, South Carolina. My grandmother-in-law, she is 83 years old. She wears thick glasses. She has curly gray hair.
I think she's about 4 years widowed now.
Lives with my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was recently returning from a trip out of town,
as soon as she got home, my grandmother-in-law comes out on the back porch to meet her, and she's very upset. She's distraught, and she says, well, my dog is in the pound. And my mother-in-law says, what do you mean your dog's in the pound? She thought for a minute she was talking about her Boston Terrier. And she says, no, my dog on Farmville. My dog's been thrown in the pound. You've got to go to the store and you've got to buy farm dollars for me. The obvious answer was to drive 30 miles to Target, buy the card for $30, and turn around and drive back home that very night so she could get her dog out of the pound.
I got the farmland blues. I got the farmland blues right now.
Hi, my name is Terry Garrido.
I'm Don Wright.
My name is Terry Bogey. I live in Birmingham, Alabama.
Ostrander, Ohio.
Issaquah, Washington. With a couple of my kids and a big dog and a garden, and life is great.
The games make you interact with other
people that I haven't talked to in 35 years.
From all over the country.
200 people that you haven't talked to in 20 plus years. Kind of a trip. My girl is 7 years old. She plays a number of the games that I play. We'll be back to back or next to each other on PCs playing these Farmville games, and she has learned a tremendous amount. There's a commerce aspect, a growing time, and a harvesting, and we don't spend very much time on it, so it's not like we're spending 3 hours in front of a computer. But every couple of days, she says, let's check the farm and see what's going on.
Girl from Egypt that comes to mind. We've talked about politics, and it's really interesting because in her real life, she's afraid to talk about politics. But I mean, I've reached mutual respect and understandings with her and learned things from her in ways that, you know, I never would have expected from the game.
It's not a tremendous amount of money. I think I'm into them for less than $100 at this point. As time goes on, I'm sure they'll get more of my cash. I don't smoke, so how do people waste their money on cigarettes? But if it's something that brings them pleasure, then, you know, who am I to judge?
I got the farmland blues right now.
Still, you gotta ask, is it odd to spend real money on virtual tomato seeds or a dog in the virtual pound? Or is their value no different than a movie ticket or an entertaining book?
Or a diamond, you know? I mean, most of a diamond's value isn't in the diamond. It's what we think of diamonds, right?
That's Clive Thompson. He's a technology writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine.
If you spend a lot of time in online games, the awesomeness of your farm, the awesomeness of the rare things you've got is exactly like a diamond, because that's where your friends see it.
We should point out that a vast majority of players do not spend real money to play games like Farmville. Only about 10% do. And I asked Clive Thompson how that works as a business model.
If you've got millions and millions of people playing, you only need to shave off, you know, 10% of those who are going to throw $50 at it, you know, a month, and suddenly you've got $50 million a month coming in.
How is this different from traditional gaming? You know, there's been The Sims around forever, mm-hmm. and these sort of massive online player communities where there have been marketplaces of one kind or another. So what is different? What's changing?
Well, the reason why this has gone so huge is that Facebook has this massive user base of people that are totally avid and are hooked up with all their friends. And this gives them something to do while they're in Facebook that's also social, you know, because you can actually do better by helping out other friends. So they sort of get you on side with making it viral because you sort of strong arm your friends who aren't playing Farmville into playing Farmville. So it's very well designed.
And the idea is to enhance, is it to make yourself better as a player?
Well, to a certain extent, the logic of games like this, these multiplayer games, is they give you something very simple to do, and it can be just sort of a fun way to while away some time when you're at work. You need 15 minutes just to not think about anything. And this gets your mind off everything else. It's the same reason people play Tetris and all those different things. But what makes this different from, you know, just sort of zoning it for 15 minutes with Tetris is that, you know, the more you play, the more experience you accrue, the more gifts you can give to friends. So it starts sort of building on itself. That's what results in the sort of, you know, 3 a.m., oh my goodness, I've been playing Farmville for 7 hours, how did this happen, phenomena that has been around for a long time in virtual world games, where people get very addicted to these very simple things that slowly build up your power or your prestige or your money or whatever, and time really slips away.
And this sort of shadow economy that's building in the gaming world, I mean, it's estimated that it's up to $1.6 billion a year in the U.S. alone is this a serious economic model for the future?
Well, you know, a lot of people have wondered about that, ranging from economists to tax authorities. Because, you know, you think about it from the IRS's point of view. If someone is inside a game and they build up tens of thousands or millions of gold pieces, and those gold pieces can be sold to someone else for, you know, a couple thousand dollars, haven't they effectively just done something, like a wagering activity that ought to be taxed, you know? And so the IRS sort of wonders about this stuff. Now, they haven't actually really come down on either side of it very heavily because the stakes aren't yet big enough. But one can imagine a period in the future when enough people are doing things like this that is really worth something in the outside world that, you know, tax authorities start going, you know, we want a piece of this. This is an active discussion amongst economists who follow virtual economies.
That's Clive Thompson, a technology writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine. He joined us from our NPR bureau in New York City. Clive Thompson, thank you.
No problem.
One thing that was clear today is that the iconography of the 1963 march is just as powerful as it was 47 years ago. And a new book explores the stories of the lesser-known faces in those famous pictures. It's called Nobody Turn Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Charles Eichner is the author, and he joins me in the studio. Charles Eichner, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, I really love the book because it's not just a chronology. It's actually more of a mosaic of
right.
characters. And it's interesting because you introduce us to so many people, and yet we experience the event through their eyes. And I want to know why you took that particular approach.
Well, the March on Washington is really an iconic event, but it's been reduced to four words. I have a dream over the years. And those are, in fact, four of the greatest words ever uttered in American political oratory. But the reason they were so powerful was because of the people who were on the Mall. And so I wanted to get down onto the grounds of the Mall and figure out who some of those people were and what their experiences were.
Who of the average folks who went to the march that you discovered affected the way you viewed this event?
Well, I keep thinking about a man named Hank Thomas. He lives down in Georgia now. And he was a student at Howard University who got involved in all kinds of civil rights activities as a student there. And he had been active in civil rights since the time he was a little boy. He would go into the library, even though he knew he wasn't supposed to because he was black. And he became a big, strong, intimidating man. And he would just stare people down whenever they came up to him. And that kind of physical strength and that moral strength, I think, is one of the things that made this movement so great, is that these people embodied these values in their very being.
You talk about the behind-the-scenes conflict in the days leading up to the march, and I'm thinking in particular the battle between John Lewis. Today he's a congressman.
Right.
Back then, of course, he was this very fiery young chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But there were little battles between him and Patrick O'Boyle, who was the Archbishop of Washington at the time. Tell us a little bit about what it was that was the nugget of contention.
John Lewis wrote a speech that was very fiery, very strong, and impatient. It expressed the impatience of youth in the country at the time.
Right, because these young people were fresh off the freedom rides.
Right.
I mean, they had just come from this summer of traveling the interstate buses and getting beaten for it in many instances.
And Lewis's speech really expressed that anger and that urgency. And he used words like revolution. And he said at one point that we will lead a Sherman's march and destroy segregation ourselves if we have to. Now, when you talk about General Sherman, them's fighting words in the South.
Right.
And so Archbishop O'Boyle was really concerned about what he considered to be incendiary language. Now, when this debate all happened, this all broke the night before the march on Tuesday night, the 27th. When this all broke, there was a big debate going out. They got Martin Luther King involved. They got A. Philip Randolph. They got Roy Wilkins. And there was a real split among the leadership. Some of the leaders said, you know what? These kids have a right to say what they want to say. Others said, we risk driving a wedge right in the middle of our movement.
It sounds like the march organizers really wanted to be very clear and, I don't know, palatable,
right,
I guess, to the American audience that was watching.
Well, I think one of the key things about the march, and the reason I think it was such a critical moment in history, was that America saw the civil rights movement, as I said before, in all of its glory. And they saw how dignified these protesters were. They saw how clear they were. They saw how fair-minded they were. And King and others were really conscious of presenting the best possible face to the public. And so King especially wanted to focus on two values. One was nonviolence. Whatever you do, never, ever fight back. You lower yourself when you fight back. And two, integration. We don't want to be a separate people. We want to become part of the American system. We don't want to defeat whites. We want to join them in a new nation. We want to join them in a new system or a new community. And it was that middle-of-the-road message, if you will, that kept everything together.
Did you get the sense there that on that day that people knew they were making history, that 47 years later people would still be talking about that day?
Well, that was one of the things that surprised me, is that they really did, because when they got there, the atmosphere was electric. And all kinds of people told me the same story in different ways. They would hear a phrase from, say, Martin Luther King, something about, whether he was talking about the dream, for example. When he used that phrase, all across the mall, in little pockets of the mall, people would shout out to each other, "I have a dream, I have a dream." And they felt the electricity, and they knew that it was different. They knew that they and America had never seen anything like that before. And a lot of people since then have tried to recapture that magic, but it really is a one-time only thing.
Charles Eichner is the author of Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Charles, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Months ahead, our troops will continue to support and train Iraqi forces, partner with Iraqis in counterterrorism missions, and protect our civilians and military efforts. But the bottom line is this: the war is ending.
President Barack Obama, from his weekly address, foreshadowing the message of his primetime speech Tuesday on ending the war in Iraq. With me to discuss this and the week's other biggest news stories is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Jim, welcome.
Hello, Roddy. Nice to talk to you.
So let's start with President Obama, because he is essentially kicking off the midterm election push by listing the drawdown from Iraq as an accomplishment.
He is. And as I heard this speech today and look forward to the one next week from the Oval Office, I thought about an interview I had 4 or 5 years ago with Bill Clinton after he was out of office. And he was saying that when it came to any national election, a midterm like the one we're having now, or a presidential election, there really were three factors you had to combine. You had to have the candidate. You needed to have the issues, which at this stage in the midterms are pretty much set. The unemployment levels, a certain state, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are a certain state. But then he said you needed to have a story. And what we're beginning now at this stage of the election cycle is the administration and the Democrats and the Republicans setting out their stories. And so the story for the war in Iraq, which was of white-hot importance 2.5 years ago in the primary elections and still very important 2 years ago in the presidential elections, was the president will say, "I told you 2 years ago I would wind up our commitment in Iraq, and I am doing that. The problems aren't all over. There still are challenges ahead, but America's formal combat engagement there has come to an end. That's what I said. That's what I've done. So that's my story."
But 2 years ago, the economy ended up overshadowing things, and it seems like the same thing is happening now. What spin can the White House really put on this?
Well, this obviously is a more challenging one for them, because their argument essentially is it would have been worse if we hadn't done X, Y, and Z. The unemployment rate, now nearly 10%, might have been 11% or higher if we hadn't done these things. It's always
right, proving
hard
a negative, saying that yes, it would have been worse is never easy.
Right. And so I think that we see in the micro level, they're doing things like this past week, Joe Biden went to an auto plant, I think a General Motors plant, and said, look, the auto industry, which looked extinct a year ago, is coming back in the U.S. And probably probably will have as the election draws near more of a comparative or negative tone saying, we may be having troubles, but the Republicans would do X, Y, and Z, and so do you want that again?
So, Jim, we don't want to leave out the Republican Party because, obviously, it's also trying to position itself for fall. But what does this past week of primary elections, with the sort of dueling endorsements and troubles for some of their incumbents, tell us about where the party stands right now?
I think when it comes to the national narrative, the story for the Republicans, of course, is we don't like the direction things are going. It looks like taxes will have to go up. Unemployment has not improved. The deficit projections look troublesome. So that's the negative case they can make.
But is everyone on board with what the story is? I mean, you look at the rally this morning, sponsored by Glenn Beck, Speaker Sarah Palin, not with any particular party, the party distancing itself from it. These are their voters, though, in a way. And I guess I'm not seeing the unified way forward there.
There is a way in which it's easier for the Republicans in this midterm election with their large sort of shaggy coalition, including Tea Party members, to do what the Democrats did in 2006, which is essentially to register discontent. And for reasons ranging from unemployment to cultural dislocation to what have you, a lot of people are uncomfortable with the direction of national politics, it seems. And so the opportunity for the Republicans is to channel that in the way the Democrats did 4 years ago in their midterm elections against the Bush-Cheney administration. And the offsetting challenge for the Democrats is to say, look, we are going someplace. The Republicans don't actually have an answer, but those are the two dynamics.
So, Jim, also this week, we saw former President Jimmy Carter help negotiate the freedom of an American prisoner from North Korea and help him get to the States this week.
I should disclose here that I once worked for Jimmy Carter. I was a speechwriter when he was in the White House. And this is actually the second time that he's been there on a sort of intervening mission like this. Bill Clinton also has been within the last couple of years. And Al Gore was there recently to get out two Americans who were prisoners there. And part of the cycle that goes on here is the North Korean leadership sort of creating emergencies which need to be solved one way or another. Of course, the Americans create emergency by violating North Korean law. But then it's sort of North Korea, the main leverage it has in the world is to sort of draw attention to itself and get the U.S. and China and Japan to pay attention to it. And there was the extra backflip here of the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, not being present when President Carter was there. And so people are trying to suss out, was this a calculated insult? One doesn't really know. The main thing about North Korea is that each time something like this happens, there's endless attempts to figure out what it means since no one can be sure.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic and our regular news analyst. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Audie. My pleasure.